Great to have you along for Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. When the pandemic started and the world went into lockdown, we were still in ski season here in the Rocky Mountains. The resorts closed, but my family was lucky. In a half hour, we could be skiing in the backcountry. Now, back then, I felt too guilty to post pictures of our adventures online when I knew that most people were stuck in their homes and apartments. Well, in England, wildlife filmmaker James Aldred was just getting ready to film the nesting season of a family of goshawks. The lockdown there brought unusual quiet to New Forest National Park, where Aldred was planning on filming. And that made it easier to capture sounds such as these. The documentary he was filming is called The New Forest, The Crown's Hunting Ground. It will be out later this year. But in the meantime, he's released a new book, Goshawk Summer, A New Forest Season Unlike Any Other. He's joining us now by phone from England to share the story. Welcome to Constant Wonder.
Well, thank you very much. Good to be here.
So I guess you're really familiar with this particular forest, so you really could tell a difference during lockdown. Would you describe that difference?
Yeah, well, I grew up in the New Forest, and but I haven't lived there for many years. And it's always been a very, very popular place. You know, Britain is getting increasingly crowded. It's only a small collection of islands, really, and there's some 65 million of us. So outdoor spaces like national parks attract a lot of attention. And during lockdown, when I first started filming there, it was just like someone had sort of pressed pause on the world, really, and it stopped turning. All the people disappeared, went to ground. I mean, literally evaporated. It was extraordinary. And all the woods and heaths and the landscape were sort of eerily silent, you know, very quiet. No traffic noises, no planes, even the planes coming into Heathrow and, you know, the big airports had stopped. And the New Forest is very much on the you know, underneath these flight paths. So it wasn't just sort of human presence on the ground. It was in the sky as well. Everything just seemed to disappear. And it was as if sort of time had been rolled back, really.
Did it feel more like when you were a child?
It did, actually. I mean, it's a difficult one to quantify that because, you know, we're all sort of, you know, guilty of looking back with rose-tinted spectacles sometimes, you know, if we're lucky to grow up in a nice place, then fond memories. And you never really sort of remember the bad things. And I certainly remember the forest being a lot quieter back then. I mean, it still got really busy, but compared to today, it wasn't experiencing anything like the pressures. So, yes, certainly at first it reminded me of sort of childhood days spent in the forest. So that was, you know, sort of 35 odd years ago or whatever. But more than that, really, is sort of the quiet settled and people got into a new routine whereby they weren't going outside and nature started to react to that very quickly, actually. It took advantage. A lot of the birds and animals started to reclaim the roads. You know, a lot of the animals were using roads and things.
Give me some examples of some of the sightings that you saw that were unusual because of the quiet.
Well, it was quite poignant, really, in a way, because we had a lot of fox cubs, so red foxes. I mean, we obviously don't get coyotes or wolves, and so foxes are our largest native canid. And, you know, they're very special animals, but they've been hammered for centuries. You know, they're very timid and used to being hunted, etc. But they were breeding at the time that lockdown began. And so the cubs, their first couple of weeks above ground, when they'd never even seen a human being, I sort of encountered quite a few of them playing on the roads around the forest because they just saw it as an open, sort of safe place to play. They could see, ironically, they could see predators coming. You know, they just felt safe there in the middle of normally very, very busy A roads. So that was one really good sort of indication that something unusual was happening. and herds of ponies. So the New Forest has had this sort of relationship with livestock, which goes back at least 1,000 years to when William the Conqueror established it. So after the Normandy the Norman conquest in 1066, he didn't waste any time. He set the New Forest up as a private hunting reserve in 1079. And it's pretty much stayed as a protected landscape since then. And one of the things that the local people who are referred to as commoners, not because they're necessarily common, although I probably am, but it's more to do with the fact that they were allowed to work common land. And part of that contract was allowing them to put livestock out to graze and browse. And that still exists today. So the New Forest is kind of famous for having a lot of free-ranging livestock, a lot of ponies, a lot of cattle, sheep and pigs and all the rest of it. And you expect to encounter these animals on the roads day and night as it was. But in lockdown, they were very quick to work out that, you know, a road was a great place to go for a canter or a gallop. So, you know, you'd sort of come around the corner and there'd be a herd of 30 ponies barreling down the road towards you, you know. So, you know, which was wonderful, wonderful experience. And it was nice to see them being so opportunistic and taking advantage of this space.
And then what happened when lockdown was lifted, and yet people are still under pandemic restrictions and maybe they can't travel? You describe a very different scene in your book.
Yeah, it was the flip side, really. It was a real shame because lockdown had potential to do wonderful things for nature, and it did. But the downside of that was that it kind of blew up in everyone's faces a little bit at the end because, as you say, people were then released from strict lockdown and they were allowed to travel for exercise. And I think that was the real ambiguity that, you know, there was a lot of confusion as to how far away from home was a reasonable distance to travel. So we had people coming down from, you know, sort of sometimes a couple of hundred miles away down to the national parks. And it's a real dichotomy. It's a real double-edged sword because these places only exist because people invest in them. And you can only invest in an area and feel love for an environment if you're allowed to go there. You know, it has to resonate with you on a personal level. So the whole point of a national park is that it has to be a very inclusive area, and rightly so. But I think what was experienced in the aftermath of lockdown was a sort of knee-jerk reaction, a desperation in a way, of just needing to get outdoors to really let off some, you know, steam. And there were a lot of people, everyone ended up in the same place, basically. And it was very unfortunate because you end up vying for the same resources. So, you know, parking spaces, road access, all of this. And of course, you know, it's not what most people signed up for. It leads to a bit of friction and stuff. And so it brought out not necessarily the best in people. And there was a very large impact and footprint on the forest. And certainly a lot of the ground nesting birds failed. Their breeding season, the season was catastrophic as a direct result for, you know, this sort of impact. And I mean, in the long term, it's all leveled out. It's all fine. But it was I suppose what I'm getting at is it was a very interesting insight into what the New Forest might actually be like in another 20 or 30 years as the pressure from our increasing population continues to grow. So actually, ironically, it gave the Forestry Commission, gave them a very useful insight into what sort of control and management processes they might need to put in place for the future.
We're speaking with James Aldred. He's the author of Goshawk Summer, A New Forest Season Unlike Any Other. So you're in the New Forest National Park in England to study goshawks, and you land on a family to study. And I want to get to know them, but tell us, first of all, what makes goshawks special? And I'm assuming you talked about that the land nesting birds really struggled, but these are not land nesting birds. These are high in the trees, right?
That's right. I mean, the goshawk, its full name is the northern goshawk. It's a true hawk. It's a accipiter. Its distribution, actually, the northern goshawk, is pretty much sort of circumpolar, really. So, you know, right through Siberia, Scandinavia, the British Isles, Northern Europe, all the way across, round through Canada, Alaska, and parts of North America. It's a sort of large hawk. It's not eagle size by any means, but it's still a, you know, it's a handful. And they're very, very secretive. The fascinating thing about goshawks is that they are ferocious hunters, actually. They sort of verge on the reckless when they get locked in on their quarry. They really are quite relentless. And they have always been prized as falconry birds. And for that reason, they're just... There's no other raptor, really, I would argue, that is as good at doing what it does as a goshawk is. And they tend to look at an item of potential prey, and they size it up, and they think, yeah, can I have you? Am I able to kill you? And if the answer is yes, because they're very intelligent animals, if they deem that that's possible, then they'll have a go. So they're not sort of typeset towards only pigeons or only rabbits or whatever. They're very opportunistic, which makes them very successful. And because that's often married with this very secretive, elusive behavior, it means that they can fly below the radar very easily and survive very, very well. It's interesting because I know in Alaska and Canada and parts of the States, there have been goshawk populations, you know, for thousands of years. But certainly in Britain, we lost our last natural sort of, as it were, indigenous goshawks. Probably about 150 years ago, they were pushed over the edge due to persecution, mostly from gamekeepers and that sort of thing, and hunting, egg collecting. And so the interesting thing about the goshawks is it is a extant niche. You know, we've always had goshawks in the environment, but we haven't had for the last century or so. So what's happened here is that in the 60s and 70s, falconers were actually bringing in birds to train up from European populations. And very often they would import two birds and work one and fly it, but just release the other. And it was a bit of a sort of surreptitious rewilding and repopulating that went on below radar. And, you know, it's great because they are it is the same species. It's a natural species. It's indigenous to Britain. But these are the only people that were really taking matters into their own hand and saying, you know what, this habitat is still perfect for them. Let's give them a helping hand. And so from that, from escapees and from ones which were deliberately let loose, we now have, it's still a very small population of between 400 and 500 pairs in the whole of Britain, as compared to like 80,000 pairs of buzzard or whatever. But they're growing. And the New Forest is certainly at saturation point. There are 45 pairs in the New Forest now. And it's because first and foremost, the New Forest is a forest. I mean, it's a mosaic landscape. There's a lot of heathland there, a lot of open places, but essentially, there's a lot of very quiet, dark, hidden away little corners, which are perfect for the goshawks, and they've taken full advantage, and they're sort of running with it, really, which is lovely, I think.
And so tell us about the nest that you decided to track, and how did you get up to it, and how high off the ground is it? How big is it? Kind of describe it for us.
Yeah. Okay, so it was in a commercial plantation, basically, of Douglas fir. Which is grown by the Forestry Commission commercially. But a lot of these stands of timber are allowed to, you know, they thin out the stands, they allow the trees to grow tall and put on mass, and they're left there for a very long time before they're harvested, if at all, quite frankly. And so this, I mean, it's classic goshawk habitat, that, because, you know, Douglas fir is so dense and dark and tall, they can hide away. And this particular nest was about 50 feet up, very large nest. I climbed up a adjacent tree about 40 feet away from it, no, a bit more than that, 50 or 60 feet away. And I put up I have a metal platform, which is about 3.5 feet square. And it's like a sort of hunting stand, really. And I sit on there, but rather than a rifle, I've got a camera on the tripod. And around me, I've got a canvas hide, you know, a tent, you know, much like a hunting blind. And there's a little slit in the front of it that looks out. And so I can peer out. And there's also a hole for the camera to stick out, as opposed to a gun or whatever.
Well, I would think a bird that was so intelligent and so aware of its surroundings would be really bothered by that.
Yeah, yes, I know. And this is the problem, because they're a Schedule 1 legally protected species, and they're really smart, they're really twitchy, and they don't suffer fools. You know, I mean, if you go anywhere near their nest and you make a mistake, then you have potentially, you know, the risk of them deserting in a failed nest, and no one really wants that on their conscience. So the whole process has to be taken very, very slowly, and it kind of relies on the relationship, the tie between the mother bird and the eggs. So you wait until the bird is sitting on eggs, and she's developing this connection with her clutch, which she's incubating. And just very, very slowly and gently, little by little, you go in one day, you just let them see you. You go away, and simple as that. The next day you go in and get a rope up the tree you want to climb, and then you go away. Then you go in, get the platform up, then you go away, maybe leave it for a few days because that's a big intrusion. And then back in and put that. So you sort of gradually try and work out how far they will let you push it. They will let you know if they're annoyed or upset. You know, A, they'll just disappear off of the nest, but B, they'll make alarm calls. And at that point, you just have to back right off and then decide whether you want to keep trying or whether you want to find another location. Because each pair of birds are very different. Some are more tolerant than others. They're all individuals. But really, it does rely on getting a hide into position whilst the parent birds have a hard, close connection with those eggs. Mm. And then by the time the chicks hatch and the season goes on, it's almost like a soft sort of self-habituation process. I always wear the same things. I always turn up the same clothes. That is, I always wear the same color climbing helmet. I turn up at the same time. I leave at the same time. I have a very strict routine. So and they're intelligent enough. They definitely recognize you over time as an individual, to the point where, you know, if a member of the public or a stranger comes into the woods later on in the season, the first thing I know about it is the birds. They just disappear, evaporate like smoke, because they've seen and heard a stranger and they've gone. And so that underlines the fact that, you know, if there's a sort of habituation process going on. And I'm not saying that they, you know, enjoy my presence at all. I mean, they don't. I'm there very much under sufferance. but at least they tolerate me. And so I would love to think that there was some sort of romantic notion of a sort of connection between yourself as a wildlife photographer and the animal that you're filming. But I think therein, you know, sort of madness lies, really. I think that can be a very dangerous route to go down because, you know, ultimately these animals are very intelligent things. They're doing their own thing. And you're just there because they don't perceive you as a threat and they're prepared to tolerate you. And that's as far as it goes.
Now, you mentioned the parents during the nesting. Tell me a little bit about the male's role in the nesting process, because I guess he kind of sticks around.
Yeah, he does. Well, he's got a very important role, actually. It's a really weird dynamic between a lot of birds of prey. There's a very large sexual dimorphism between the male and the female. So the female, quite often a third, if not a half, as big again as the male is. And that's a very interesting survival trait because it enables them as a couple to work the local ecology in terms of what they hunt very effectively. So if, for example, one year larger mammals and larger birds are at a deficit, then the male comes into play and he provides with the smaller, more agile birds that the female's a little bit too big and cumbersome to catch. Other way around works as well. You know, if the small birds have a population crash, then she becomes the main provider with things like rabbits, squirrels, and even fox cubs, stuff like that. Mm. So the dynamic is very interesting between a lot of these birds of prey, and particularly with the goshawk, because the females are particularly fiery and aggressive. They're just magnificent things. They're like I don't know if you know harpy eagles in tropical Central America and South America, but they're basically like a miniature harpy eagle. The female goshawk is an extraordinarily brazen and fiery hunter. She's very, and quite often, she will attack the male, and you know she will kill the male on occasion if he gets a bit too close to the chicks, or you know she just gets angry with him. I mean the classic condition when a female is sitting on the eggs for any amount of time is, you know, she's frustrated. She's a born killer. She's a hunting machine, and she's tied to this nest for 35 days, and she can't hunt for herself. And I see her day by day getting more irritable and more hangry. She can't eat when she wants. She can't hunt when she wants. She can't. She's tied to this nest. And I see it in the male. He gets increasingly skittish when he comes back. He's very loath to actually bring food directly to her. He'll chop it off at a sort of intermediary adjacent branch and call her, and then she'll go off and feed and go back. So sometimes it can be a very turbulent relationship. It's a contract, really, between these two birds. They both want to get their genes out there, but it's like a marriage of convenience. You know, they kind of have to put up with each other. But what's very interesting, or I found very interesting in this particular instance, is that the male and the female were super tolerant of each other. I wouldn't go as far as to say affectionate, because they're still, you know, they're like, you know, they're still little velociraptors covered in feathers. You know, when you look through the lens at their eyes, they're pretty psychotic things, really. And there's, you know, there's no affection or empathy there with them. But they were particularly tolerant of each other. And there were some very touching moments whereby the male tried to incubate the eggs, and of course he couldn't because he didn't have a brood patch. You know, he didn't have that bit of highly vascularized warm skin on his breast that the female does. So he could do no more than sit on the eggs and basically keep them warm rather than actually heating them. But she would tolerate him and let him do that, and then he would sort of begrudgingly get up off of them when she got back, and you know, she would sort of gently nudge him off, and he would bring in food for her to eat, very, very well stocked sort of larder, you know, to the point of overflow, really. He was relentless. It was almost like he defaulted to the only one, to the one role he knew how to play and play well, which was hunting for her and the brood. So he did it to excess, which was extraordinary. But yeah, very, very, very different. But she was all about power and muscles and sheer brutishness. Very formidable bird. And he was... he was so sort of fey and delicate and kind of sophisticated in a way that he almost looked like he had just stepped through from a different dimension. I had this feeling time and time again. He would just arrive with no more than a whisper of sound, like a ghost. He would land on the nest, he'd deliver the food, and he'd just poof, he'd just be gone again.
And it, so did the roles change once the chicks hatched?
Yes, it did. I mean, she definitely, as the chicks grew larger, she definitely became the main provider. So he was still bringing in prey in relation to his own hunting abilities and size. So mostly small songbirds and pigeons, things like that. But because the chicks were getting so much larger and they needed a lot of calories, and there were three of them, two females and a male. You know, sooner or later, I mean, the chicks very quickly got much larger than their father. So he was too frightened to land on the nest. So the mother, the female parent bird, had to really step in and to feed their hunger. So she was bringing in squirrels, rabbits, all of these much larger stuff, which the male just doesn't have the ability to catch. So she became the primary sort of breadwinner then. And she was amazing, actually. She would catch. We've got grey squirrels, which were introduced to the British Isles, 70, 80 years ago, from North America. And you know, there are good populations of grey squirrel in the New Forest. And she just went through them like a dose of salt. She would hit them so hard that the sound of them being thumped against the tree would sort of echo through the woods. And the next thing, she'd bring back this little bedraggled body, and you know. And within seconds, there's nothing left of it. It's just scraps of fur and flesh flying everywhere. It's quite macabre, really. But she kept that going as a non-stop thing. I mean, the sheer amount of prey that nest got through in that one breeding season just beggars belief. You know, so from the point of view of pest control, you know, goshawks are pretty good. You know, they're taking a lot of corvids, a lot of pigeons, a lot of squirrels. So they are kind of the forester's friend in that respect. Very impressive bird.
Well, James Aldred, your passion for this family of goshawks is also very impressive, and I really appreciate you sharing their story with us today. Just finally, as we kind of go stumbling back into normal life, hopefully, what lessons would you like to share from the forest during this really special time of lockdown that you got to observe?
I think we could all tread far lighter than we do. I think we should, as a species, lower our expectations. I think we really need to take a long, hard look at our own sense of self-entitlement. And I think, you know, at the very least, you know, our relationship with nature is like our relationship with another person or animal or any sort of relationship. The more we lean forward, the more nature is going to lean back. So sometimes all we need to do is just take a moment, realize that actually we're the new kids on the block, quite frankly, and just to lean back and avoid falling into the trap of hubris. Nature isn't there to serve us. We're there to serve it. And I think lockdown was a real eye-opener for people in as much as, certainly in Britain, you know, we realized, a lot of people have said to me that they realized that it didn't take much. All they had to do was, you know, do a little bit less, you know, sort of impact. And nature responds beautifully. It knows what to do if you just give it half a chance. So I think that's the lasting lesson, I think, that I've taken away from it, certainly.
James Aldred is the author of Goshawk Summer, A New Forest Season Unlike Any Other. Later this fall, you'll be able to see the documentary he was filming. It's called The New Forest, The Crown's Hunting Ground. So watch for that. Thank you so much for sharing this story with us.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
This is Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor.
This is Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. When humans flee but nature stays, nature usually doesn't mind so much. But when we leave a nuclear mess behind, that's a very different matter. At Chernobyl, Timothy Mousseau, a professor of biological sciences from the University of South Carolina, found drunken spider webs. He told me about them when I spoke with him.
Spider webs are absolutely mysterious expressions of that, you know, the individual's state. And they're everywhere, but you often don't even see them if they're because they're often in the shadows and the light doesn't hit them just right. And you know, one day we were doing some work in the Chernobyl Red Forest area, one of the most radioactive parts of the zone. And, you know, it just hit me that, wow, we're walking through this dense kind of forest with, you know, no spiders. They were clearly absent. And so we started counting them and verified that they were in much lower numbers in these more radioactive areas of Chernobyl. And then, you know, a year or two later, I decided, well, let's take a look at their web. If you bring a spray bottle, mister, you can, you know, spray these areas where there's likely to be spider webs, and they'll just sort of magically appear, and you can photograph them. And when we did this, we realized, oh my goodness, you know, the it was striking that the webs in the most radioactive areas were dramatically different, much more aberrant than the webs from sort of clean, normal areas. And what was particularly revealing was the fact that we went to Fukushima the first year after, or actually within months of the actual disaster in 2011, the webs there in many areas were similarly aberrant, strange.
When you say aberrant, I'm imagining a web made by a spider that doesn't seem to be sober.
Exactly. You know, most spider webs, you look at them and you go, wow, that's a wonder of symmetry and shape and you know, how do they do it? And these spider webs, many of these spider webs, you'd look at them and go, wow, this spider was clearly out of whack, you know, normal conditions, and, you know, sort of walking erratically across the web and putting segments where there shouldn't be segments, and the whole areas were missing, and yeah, clearly a drunken spider.
So have you been able, I mean, aside from observing that this has happened, has anybody been able to see cause and effect or prove cause and effect there from the radiation is causing these spiders to behave in this way?
You know, like so much that goes on in Chernobyl and more recently in Fukushima, you know, everyone gets excited by these observations. And, you know, I'll get, you know, again, hundreds of emails from folks who are interested. But the funding agents, you know, they're not so interested in aberrant spider webs. They're not particularly interested in aberrant bird calls. You know, the only thing they're really interested in is whether or not, you know, the radiation causes cancer or something similar. It's very challenging to find people who are able and willing to do research on these more esoteric kinds of questions. And certainly spider web morphology, you know, falls into the esoteric category.
Timothy Mousseau, a professor of biological sciences at the University of South Carolina. I'm Marcus Smith for Constant Wonder. Her name was Marie Aymar, and she was an illiterate widow in a provincial town in the southwest of France. Documents found tucked away in archives have revealed fascinating insights into her story and the 300-year story of her extended family, right down to the present day. You're about to hear a story full of surprises, you know, the dramatic stuff from triumph to tragedy. You're listening to Constant Wonder.
Welcome to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. C.S. Lewis wrote, "There are no ordinary people." And yet, history is generally told through the stories of people who seem extraordinary, who accomplish unusual feats. One historian, however, has decided to tell history by following one family for 300 years. We're going to get a glimpse of that history today. Lessons from Ordinary Life. Emma Rothschild is a professor of history at Harvard University. She's also the author of An Infinite History, the Story of a Family in France Over Three Centuries. Welcome to Constant Wonder.
It's wonderful to be with you. Thank you.
Now, this story starts with a widow named Marie. Who was she?
She was illiterate. She was born in a small provincial town in France at the beginning of the 18th century. She was married to a carpenter, and he left as an indentured laborer to go to the Caribbean, where he was hoping, I think, to make his fortune or his family's fortune. And he died on the way home. And she had heard a rumor that he'd actually succeeded and he'd managed to buy a number of Negro slaves, as she put it. And after his death, she was wanting to find out what had happened to his fortune. So that was how I came upon her. And I was intrigued by this story because it seemed to be a connection between an illiterate widow in the middle of France and the great world of slavery and war. Then the next thing I found out about her had to do with her daughter, who was getting married to the son of a tailor in the town. And it was a perfectly ordinary marriage. They signed a prenuptial contract, and 83 people showed up to sign their prenup. So this made me intrigued. Why were there so many people there? Who were those people? What were they so interested in? And somehow out of these two events, her looking for what had happened to the possible slaves that her husband might have bought, and her sociable daughter, I kind of got completely captivated and tried to follow this family forward in time.
Well, whatever happened to the fortune?
I am pretty certain that it never existed. I've looked and looked, and one of the strange things about doing this work is that I kept thinking I might find something that Marie couldn't find out, that Marie didn't know, because I was able to go to the archives in London, for example, because the place where her husband lived later became an English colony. And I kept thinking, am I going to find a record that actually he wasn't dead and he was living with another woman? But no, it's pretty clear that the money was never there. And it was just one of those rumors. The family was certainly extremely poor for the rest of their lives. So I don't think it ever existed.
I'm curious why somebody who was not very fancy would have a prenuptial agreement. Is that Is that normal? And why so many people signing on?
It was fairly normal to do a prenup in this little town. I mean, I found one prenup between a beggar and the daughter of a beggar, where they each put the equivalent of $2 into the family property. What was extremely unusual was to have so many people. I've looked at, you know, hundreds and hundreds of prenups, and I don't think I've ever seen even as many as half as many people. So they were a sociable family. In modern terms, they had a pretty extensive social network. Being a tailors were very kind of sociable people, because in those days they went from house to house, you know, making clothes for people. My hunch is that all those people were simply inquisitive, that they'd heard this strange story just a few weeks ago that the bride might be the heiress to a fortune and a lot of slaves in a far-off island, and they sort of wanted to see what was happening. That's my hunch, but it's one of the many things one never knows.
And you decided to try to track down everyone who signed that registry, that document. How successful were you, and why did you think that was so important?
I wanted to see if it could be done. I'm pretty confident about 80 of the 83 people. And, you know, doing history, the practice of doing history has changed so profoundly over the last 10 or 20 years, really since I've started working on this project, because I can read the parish records online at home in the middle of the night after I've finished my work. So it was really just curiosity, inquisitiveness, like the people who came to sign the prenup. And there's a large historical question which goes right through the book, which is to do with how much did people know about slavery and about what was happening in the distant colonies. As you, in France, as in Britain and in the United States, there's a major societal reckoning with what's called the legacies of slavery. But it's much more difficult to try and understand what slavery meant to people, as you say, to ordinary people, ordinary families who were far away from colonies and plantations. And I think that's why I was interested in finding all these people, apart from the sort of crossword puzzle aspect of it, which undoubtedly is part of the story.
Did you figure out if they really understood the enterprise that this fortune was based on?
Well, I'll give you an example. There was the bridegroom in the prenup had a second cousin who was one of the signatories of the prenup, and he had a brother in the French colony that's now Haiti. This brother was fairly easy to find in the publications from that colony. He was a particularly brutal slave owner who actually went bankrupt. He, for example, I found an advertisement for, he was looking for a runaway slave who was 8 months pregnant and was branded on her breast with his initials. So he was a pretty awful person born in this small town. Now, the brother who signed the prenup corresponded with the family member in Haiti repeatedly. He, in fact, was trying to send one of his sons over to work with his brother. So I think that there were close family connections to the world of slavery, and that itself was interesting. I mean, these are all people who weren't at all prosperous. But if you look at the richer people in the town, like, for example, the man who was Mariema's husband's employer, he owned 50 slaves. He lived on the street next door. His own father had brought a slave back to the small town where he was baptized. His brother-in-law had another slave who was baptized in the town, described as belonging to the brother-in-law. So I was trying to describe a network of information about distant slavery as a way of answering the historian's, you know, long-standing question of how do great events fit together with the small events in the lives of unfamous families.
Mm. You make a point of tracking the economic disparity that appears within the generations of Marie's family. Will you explain that?
Yes. I go into the fifth generation, Marie's grandchildren's grandchildren. And by then, the economic inequality within the extended family is dramatic. What Marie's youngest son actually went to the modern Haiti himself he was a watchmaker, and he wasn't a landowner, but he did own slaves, or so he said. His descendants lived in extreme poverty in Paris. One of them had 10 children, of whom 9 died in infancy. Mm. Her sister was a street seller. So they were, as they described themselves, really on the verge of destitution. One of the descendants in the same generation of the bride in the prenup became an extremely rich heiress whose daughter married into the aristocracy of Napoleon III. Her husband actually had a pretty sticky ending because he was a banker who was disgraced for fraud, but though they remained pretty rich in spite of that. So again, and I can follow the family into the large events of the French Revolution, but also into the big changes that took place in the 19th century to do with industrialization or growing economic inequality. That both branches of the family lived in Paris, and we've actually mapped their addresses over the course of the 19th century. And on the website for the book, infinitehistory.org, we're about to publish a map of the rich family and the poor family and their trajectory over time, with little pictures from Google Street View of what the streets look like now. And it's a very vivid demonstration of spatial as well as economic and social inequality. So through looking at a family and through doing many of the sorts of things that family historians do, that people who are interested in ancestry do, I hope I've managed to say something about the large events of historical time, or at least to raise questions that make people think about some of these large events.
Emma Rothschild, I'd just like to talk about a couple of the people who were players in larger events, like the French Revolution. Could you tell us a little bit about Étienne Ferrand and Rose Marin?
Yes. Rose Marin was the youngest of the signatories of the prenup, and she shows up in the document in a very strange way, because she was misclassified in the police records, and she was trying at the height of the French Revolution to prove that she actually was a pro-revolutionary person. Mm. This is sort of unusual, because mostly it's men who are having to do this. There's another young woman, not a relative of Marie's, but a close neighbor in the town, who herself went to Paris and was basically a maid in an aristocratic household. She had the opposite experience in that she suddenly decided that she loved the king, and she, one evening with another young woman who was a hairdresser, they walked into a police station and handed over a written document declaring their faith in the monarchy and their hatred of the revolution. Oh. So that became quite a famous case. They were two young women, as the French said, of the people, but who had quite the wrong political views. And it's a tragic story that I followed. This I followed in the archives in Paris. I mean, they were both guillotined about 3 days after they walked into the police station. Mm-hmm. So there were people on all sides. I think Marie's family were broadly on the pro-revolutionary side.
Etienne, he was a priest. How did he help the revolution?
Etienne was Marie-Aimard's grandson. He became a priest just before the revolution. And when the revolution came, he decided that he was going to be part of that side of history. What that meant was that he got married, for example. In fact, he married a former parishioner, and then he did leave the church. What's frustrating in relation to Etienne is that I absolutely was unable to find what happened to him next. For many of these family members, it was fairly easy to track them over the five generations I was interested in, and even to the present, although I didn't put that in the book because I didn't, in a way, want to sort of invade the privacy of people who are living. But in Etienne's case, he completely vanished. My suspicion is that he probably changed his name, because after the revolution and when the monarchy came back, it was quite a dangerous thing to be a priest who had married and become what's called a juring priest, a priest who swore allegiance to the revolution. So my guess is he and his wife changed their names and vanished. So this is one of the aspects of doing an inquiry of this sort. But, you know,
I have a question for you, though. Why would you not want to bring this family history up to the present? You said you didn't want to encounter people who might still be living.
Look, the story is a dramatic story. There are people who lived very complicated lives. There are people who were slave owners. There are people who were fierce revolutionaries. And I wasn't sure that I wanted to kind of force this on people who were alive. I mean, it's interesting. I'm afraid authors do this, but I was looking at French Amazon, and I saw that somebody had commented on the book, and she said she was finding it very interesting in terms of her own researches into her family in the region. So I can't say I was unhappy about this, but actually I don't think, oddly enough, there are all that many. I mean, the poor daughter who lost 9 of her 10 children was not uncommon in the 19th century. And there's one famous person in the entire extended family, and he became a very famous cardinal, the Cardinal of Algiers. Oddly enough, he was a worldwidely known opponent of the Trans-Saharan slave trade, and he had no children. Mm. His brother and sister had no children. So, I don't think it's an enormous population of people who will be walking around France, and when the book comes out in French, will say, "Oh, that's terrible. That's my great great aunt Jeanne."
Emma Rothschild is the author of An Infinite History, the story of a family in France over three centuries. Why do you think this is a good model for history. It's not organized around one event. It's not limited to a geographical region. Instead, it's more like family history telling world history. Why do you like that model?
I don't want to say that this is a model for a way of doing history. And I certainly don't want to say that these are a representative family. And I don't think the archives of this small town are representative, partly because there are so many of them. The Angoulême, the town which is at the center of the story, was actually a paper-making town. And I think the officials and archivists simply had a love of records and writing things down on paper. So they're extraordinarily well-kept archives and records. So I don't think this is something that can be done in this form for many other places. But what I deeply believe is that there are many models historians who want to write about small and large events. I hope the book will encourage people to experiment with different ways of telling historical stories, with going from a small story to a larger story to a maybe to a global story. And I also would be very happy if people who are looking for their own ancestors read the book and thought, well, maybe I shouldn't just look for my own great-grandmother, but I should look for her unmarried sisters who might have done interesting things, or I should look for the people who were her friends or who she worked with or who lived on the same street. I mean, I wanted to convey a sense of the multiplicity of historical information that's available. It's more a model of thinking that many models are possible.
Emma Rothschild is the author of An Infinite History, The Story of a Family in France Over Three Centuries. You can find out more information about the families and find that map she referred to at our website. We'll have a link to it. We're at byuradio.org. Thank you for sharing this history with us today.
Thank you. It's been great talking to you.
This is Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor.
And I'm Marcus Smith. Moving our bodies and transporting our stuff, these have been obsessions since, well, since before the invention of the wheel, actually, probably long before that. The wheel was a sort of solution, but since that invention, we've never stopped moving. Human History as Motion and Locomotion, Monday here on the show. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.